ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
It's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Hello and welcome to The Bookshelf here on ABC Radio National. I'm Kate Evans.
And I'm Cassie McCullough, and this is where we review new fiction each week from Australia and around the world.
This time we're going to highlight two types of reading. We're going to talk about the short story, an antidote, Cassie, to all those long books that we seem to have grappled with recently. And we're also going to talk about crime fiction, including Australian, American, number of series, and the latest in the Swedish series about Lisbeth Salander, which began with The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Well, also short stories, and at the very top of the stack, the latest from someone called Salman Rushdie.
Cassie, we last read Salman Rushdie's fiction together in early 2023 with his novel Victory City, which was a sprawling novel about, well, it was wild, it was magical, and it was really quite something, that one.
Yeah, it was about what India was before it was India, and full of principalities and wars and elephants and magical, really. It was wonderful. I loved Victory City. Then, of course, he'd completed that novel when the terrible incident happened.
Yes, he was stabbed in August of 2022, lost an eye. And the book that we're going to talk about now is the first work of fiction that he's written since then. It's a collection of short stories called The 11th Hour.
So it's five different stories of varying length. The first one, Kate, is about two 81-year-olds who are called Senior and Junior, who were born 17 days apart, and they live in adjacent apartments in a block in Chennai, which is sort of several streets back from Elliot's Beach, which is the ritzy part of town. And they're always quarrelling.
I really loved the feel of this story. I mean, it is quite short, and we've got these two men living next to each other. One has had quite a successful life, you know, lots of children, grandchildren, but he's the grumpy one, whereas Junior has lived a life of sort of quiet disappointment in a way, but he's lived it with joy. And I love the way we were taken into these lives, these personalities, these sort of daily interactions of these people at the end of their lives. Mm.
Yes, and it's the first of many opposites in this collection of short stories. Senior, as you said, he's the youngest of 10 kids. He had 9 of his own. He's got 33 grandkids. His siblings had 33 offspring, and they have 111 grandchildren. Junior, so that's 205, apparently, family members all told for Senior. Junior was an only child who never married. So it is short, but it's very poignant. And it's the first of a disappearance or a ghostly presence as well.
Yes, and there's a sense of mortality, of that 11th hour looming. And so with that as the first thing to read in this collection, it felt very promising to me. I felt like I was being set up to enjoy where we were going to be taken. And then where we're taken is into a very different place and story, The Musician of Kahani, and this story is sort of the length of a novella.
Mm, it is quite long and a lot happens, but I'll just quickly explain the setup. Rahim and Mina are both academics. He's a maths professor. She was his student. She's 20 years younger than him, and she's become an information technology genius. And Mina fell in love with Rahim when he quoted Einstein in a lecture, the line from his famous 1954 letter to the German philosopher Erich Gutkind: "The word of God for me is nothing but the expression and product of human weakness." So this What's the thing she loved about him? Now, Rahim has just cracked a proof of Fermat's last theorem, which had been unsolved for more than 350 years. But before he could publish it, an Englishman beat him to it. And this actually is true, was solved in 1994 by the Englishman Andrew Wiles. So Rahim is inconsolable. His whole life's work has been, well, for nothing. Meanwhile...
Well, and meanwhile, his wife is a computer programmer and she invents something that is, well, a very effective search engine, and she is then offered $1 million by an American tech bro to buy it, and she accepts it. So she is successful, and that's part of the story. But the other thing that happens in this novel that then connects us to Salman Rushdie's earlier writing is that this couple has a child who is born at midnight. And midnight, of course, is when the children were born in his novel Midnight's Children in 1947 at the point of partition. And in this story, the child is born at midnight at the beginning of the 21st century. So we're in a world of both a very contemporary India, but also of portents and magic and possibility.
And so we come back to one of Salman Rushdie's great themes, which is actually India, and that's what Victory City was about. So at one point, Rahim is talking to his friend Shankar, not Ravi. Ravi does appear later on, Ravi Shankar. But this Shankar he's talking to, he says there are three fantasies in life. That men made gods, it was the other way around, he says, that gold is just yellow rock and money is just paper. And the third fantasy is India. Until August 15, 1947, there was no such country. It never existed before as a single entity, never in all of history. And I think this is his grand theme, which is arguing against the idea of a single country when, in fact, India comprises many religions, many people, many philosophies, languages. It is beyond simplification.
And story, and this imagined city in which this story takes place is called Kahani, which is the Urdu and Hindi word for story, for narrative. So it's all about the creation of narratives. But I wonder how much this is also a story about art, because the child, the baby, becomes a musician and various complicated things happen, and there's another awful family and, you know, who are the bad guys in the story. But it ends up where music itself rains down vengeance and pain and passion, music that frightened everyone who heard it, that actually has consequences in the world. And then right near the end of the story, there's a reflection that Chudney, who's the child, the musician of Kahani, can be said to be one of the very rare artists whose work directly impacted and shaped the world in which she lived. And so this sense of art, writing, music, actually doing something in the world, I thought was also something he was addressing in this novel, in this short story.
Yes, and it's very magical as well. I mean, Chandni, at the age of four, simply walks up to a piano and starts playing it. And then she learns the bansuri flute, the santur and the sitar, and she's just a genius. And by the end of this story, she doesn't even need an instrument. People just hear music from her. So that's part of the Salman Rushdie magical idea of the power of creations, I think. Yes, you're right. I think there's also every story has an old male character, a flawed, complex man who also has a healthy sense of ego, healthy, yeah, like perhaps, well, I'm not sure if Rushdie's aware that he'd done that in every character, but yes, the senior and junior, Rahim and his great disappointment. Later on, we, in a story called Late, there's the honorary fellow S.M. Arthur, who's at a 600-year-old university, who's very cantankerous, and he is visited by ghosts, and there's a ghostly element to that story. Oklahoma is about an old man and a young man. And then the final piece, which is The Old Man in the Piazza, is about this old guy who goes down every day and sits at a cafe table in a piazza in a small town, and he's the audience of one for the show. And the show is that when people come into this piazza, they start arguing. And so is he the cause, or is he, as he believes, the audience? But then one day he intervenes in an argument between a husband and wife, and he becomes an oracle.
So there's a sort of lovely sense that you are reading somebody who's reflecting on a career and his ability to tell stories and what it means to look back. I mean, even the narrator in The Musician of Kahani, and we're not entirely clear who that narrator is, says, "Here I am visiting my yesterdays one last time, and they are visiting me." And so I wondered if that's what Salman Rushdie's doing.
Mm. Yeah, it's definitely a late work, I would say.
Yeah, in the best way?
Look, I think some of the stories are stronger than the others. I'm always amazed by his ability to go off on a tangent, make it real, and then bring it back to something, well, more earthly. Obviously, in any short story collection, some are stronger than others, but I'm glad I read it.
Yeah, same. And also it made me think about what it is that short fiction does and the way that it does bring you back. I mean, because the structure of a short story is so particular and so interesting. And so I wonder if I could just tell you about a few other collections of short stories that I've read. So in contrast with Salman Rushdie, I just read a collection by a debut author from Ireland whose name is Liadhan Ní Quinn. The collection's called Everyone's Still Here. They're a young writer from Northern Ireland, born in 1998, so born in the year of the Good Friday Agreement. But again and again is actually revisiting, in very contemporary ways, revisiting the history of Ireland's violence in short stories that literally made me feel breathless. They were so powerful and clear and surprising. Just to give you one example, the very first story opens with a teenage medical student. He's in first year university and he's attending an anatomy class. And the sort of the horror of being confronted by these cadavers that this character then has to approach, touch, put a scalpel in. You can hardly breathe through it because this writer makes it all so powerful and real, uses voice in a way that I haven't read for a while, and somehow makes it both about Ireland and the self and these characters, all of which are distinctly different in this collection of stories.
Okay, well, that sounds fantastic. I'm not going to attempt to pronounce that name as beautifully as you did, but of course all the books that we do talk about are listed on the Bookshelf program page. Okay, you've also read Tony Birch, Pictures of You. Tony Birch, of course, poet, novelist, short story writer, describes himself as Fitzroy Black, B-L-A-K, and writes urban, Aboriginal and, well, I guess working class stories.
And they are so beautiful and immersive and take you into place, again, places, voices, very distinct characters. Although the first couple of stories feel like he's playing a bit around with memoir, and so he uses a character whose sort of quite brutal upbringing reflects some things out of his own life. There's a lot of stories about fathers and sons, but then he also introduces sort of ghosts and less realist moments as well. But this is some of the very best of Tony Birch's short stories from across a whole career.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Pictures of You. Also, Morgan Tolte. Now, The Night of the Living Res, great title. We've read a couple of this writer's novels, and this short story collection actually was written before those. He's a Native American writer. He's a member of the Penobscot Nation. And we've really enjoyed his other works. What's the short story collection like?
Just wonderful. And it's connected short stories, which I know is something, Cassie, that we've spoken about before. Again, the real skill of taking moments. And in this case, it's of a life. It's of a character called David, who we meet as a boy. We meet as somebody trying to buy weed to smoke, and who's finds a friend who's frozen in the snow and has to scalp him by cutting off his hair. So he does he's quite funny and playful.
Hang on, that's not funny.
Well, I mean, he's not actually scalping him. All he's doing is he has to cut his friend's hair because his friend has fallen over drunk in the snow and become frozen in place. And with much hilarity, they decide the only way he can actually get his friend up is to cut his friend's hair. And so they're then joking
That's
about
a bit funnier.
Being Native Americans and scalping each other. But then there's also a sense of you have to go back and collect that hair in case it's used as bad medicine and a curse against you. So it's brutal, it's poetic, and in that way it actually sits really well next to Tony Burch's writing. They're both sort of tender as a bruise writing and showing again what it is that short fiction can do.
Well, if you're not up for a big novel, these sound like some options that might be just the thing.
So just to quickly run through them again, these collections of short stories are Salman Rushdie's The 11th Hour, Liadin Ni Queen's Everyone's Still Here, Tony Burch's Pictures of You, and Morgan Talty's Night of the Living Res.
Well, let's welcome this week's guests here on the bookshelf, documentary maker Johan Gabrielsson and crime fiction reviewer and academic Sue Turnbull. Welcome back to both of you. Great to see you.
Thank you so much.
Very happy to be here too.
Now, Sue, your latest book is an academic work which is co-authored with other writers, including the historian Kate Darian Smith. But it's a new history of migrants, television and Australian stories. I'm fascinated already. What's the connection between those three?
You know, previously books about migrants and television have often been about representation. You know, the issues of how people get represented and whether they're represented fairly or whether there's enough of them. We did something rather different. We decided we wanted to look at the ways in which migrants were working in television behind the scenes, in front, you know, how they got onto the screen. So we started doing lots and lots and lots of interviews. And that kind of fed into this incredible story and richness, so that whilst it might be assumed that migrants were, you know, not in television, they certainly were. They were behind the scenes. For example, Sonia Borg, that you might have heard of, ended up being one of the writers of Women of the Sun with Hillis Morris. And she was a migrant from Austria who became a screenwriter. And I think it's really interesting that as a migrant, she was one of the first people to embrace telling an Australian story on Australian television. So there's all these great stories. And then there's the other side of it, of migrants watching television. And that's my own particular area of interest, is kind of audience studies. And of course, what you discover is right from the very start of television, there's a very different pattern to what people are watching. And particularly among migrant groups where their English is not very good, they'll be watching entertainment and sometimes their own entertainment. There was an Italian variety show that was incredibly popular in Melbourne. So it's a story.
Yeah. And that Greek one, Let's Go Greek, Indaxi.
Absolutely. And actually, we've got some wonderful images as well of migrants in Wollongong, in the Missen huts, which are actually still on the fields of the university, sitting watching shows about speaking English, and the ways in which television was imagined as a way to kind of assimilate migrants and introduce them to the Australian experience. But the book ends on a very different note, because that was television, but that's not what television is now. And now, as ever, migrants are finding their way through to watch whatever they want. So it's interesting. We came across a Macedonian family where the parents came, you know, through in the 50s and never really learned to speak English. Now they're tuning into a streaming service from Turkey where they can watch Macedonian television. So they've never needed to learn to speak English. British because now they can watch their own shows.
Now, Johan, Sue in her academic work has also long been interested in Scandi-noir. Mm. But I'm curious, as a Swedish person, what do you think is distinctive about how your part of the world approaches crime stories?
I think it's interesting, and people who want to know more can do my podcast series, Noir Here This, that I plugged a few times here for you. But it takes that whole backstory about how it developed. And it's also, I mean, a bit about why I was so fascinated from the beginning, because it was like telling stories about Swedish society, about cultural events, about political events, and writing crime around it. So it was like an entertaining way for me was to read about my country, about the history, about how we built up this wearful society in this late 60s and the kind of the dark side of that that they honed into, especially two writers, Sjöwall and Wahle, who became world famous about the books and started actually that kind of revolution about using literature as a prism about society. And they're the first, but it just have gone on and on and on. And it's interesting also, I find that their books, they wrote in a very special way, but that how it's developed, I mean, today, and it keeps going, they keep selling, and it keeps spreading around the world, that kind of Nordic noir way of telling. But it's challenging. I mean, it's interesting to see how new writers take up the kind of torch and reinvent it.
What do you think's going on with the landscape and the light in the way that these stories are told, either on screen or even as they're imagined on the page?
Well, the lack of light probably is for people sitting around. I mean, it's kind of a bit of a cliche, but they say it's the, you know, one of the darkest countries in Scandinavia is Iceland, and they have almost the most crime writers. Even the president, one of the president was a crime writer. They have a huge production of crime writers, and that's the darkest. And Sweden...
But they also have the most incredible number of theatres per person. I think in Reykjavik alone, there's more than 30 theatres. So there's an upside to
the
dark.
And they have four murders a year. If it's two and a half, I can't remember. There's hardly any crime. But it's this avalanche of crime writers. So Sweden, you would find somewhere in the middle of that, in that kind of darkness and the production of crime, Nordic noir, that always, most of them, takes place in winter, autumn. And there has been a very tradition to set them in Stockholm or south of Stockholm. And that's why I'm so excited about this book, because I think it's the last maybe 10, 15 years they start to look upwards in the country, you know, like a... Is it two-thirds of the country that's supposed to be in the north of the country that hardly any people live? But very, very interesting crime takes place and crime writer work in that scenario.
And that book that you're mentioning, that is the latest in the Lisbeth Salander Millennium series from Sweden.
Yeah.
And you've read the latest book in that series by Karin Smirnoff. It's called The Girl with Ice in Her Veins. But we're going to spend the rest of this edition of The Bookshelf talking about crime fiction. And we're also going to turn to you, Sue, as well, for a bit of a guide about what's happening in Australia. But why don't we stay in the cold for a while, Cassie?
Why not? When Swedish journalist and writer Stieg Larsson's Girl with the Dragon Tattoo was published in 2005... Well, we met this fierce, damaged computer hacker called Lisbeth Salander, who didn't feel pain, had a dreadful backstory, and ended up working very closely with a groundbreaking journalist.
And his name was Mikael Blomqvist, but the author himself of that original series, he was also a journalist. He wrote this trilogy of novels, but he died unexpectedly before the books were published. Now, Johan, can you remember the impact of those novels when they were first published in Sweden?
Huge. I mean, I was traveling by the time, and I remember going to bookstores in Canada, America, secondhand bookstores, Australia. They were all there, those books. They spread like fires around the world. I think he took that, nurtured that idea that Cheval Vale had done in the 60s, and he just lifted it up to even a more seedy part of Swedish society, about racism, about violence against women, politics, the contemporary politics, what was going on around Sweden in the 80s, 90s. And he did it in a spectacular way. Also, he came from a background, he was a journalist, and he worked for a paper called Expo, which was really to expose the racist tendencies in Swedish politics and Swedish societies. And a lot of that writing and his investigation with those stories was very much colored of his books. So it was like a wake-up call that people said, my God, is it really this bad that we're living, that these tendencies goes on? Yeah, he made it really dramatic and also very believable that this was going on.
And that very first novel, I think in Swedish the title was something like Men Who Hate Women, even though in English it was called The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Sue Turnbull, did it change the field? Can you remember what impact it had here in translation? It was 2005.
I can remember doing an event in Melbourne because there was so much excitement around the book. Everybody wanted to talk about it, where it came from, what its origins were. And of course there were other writers that had made a mark before, like Henning Mankell, who had also done a series and they'd gone to television as well. There was a way in which writers like Mankell and what had gone before set the scene. There was a precedent and an interest in stories coming from Scandinavia. But yes, it came, and then of course there were film versions, and there were two, I think. There was the Swedish version, and then there was the American remake of the film.
I think there were two really striking parts to it for me when I read that book. Firstly, as you've said, Johan, revealing Sweden's, well, deep, dark fascist underbelly, which goes right back to World War II and
Nazism
earlier.
Nazism,
that's right, which I wasn't aware of. But the other thing that I think was introduced perhaps on the biggest stage was the character who, and this is Elizabeth, who is somehow on a autism spectrum, who is able to solve all these complicated computing problems, information technology systems, which now every show on television has one of those. Every crime book has somebody who can, you know, solve these plot problems, essentially. But she was unique, and she was more than just a device, actually. She was very interesting.
In fact, rereading the book, which I did recently, I had forgotten how tedious some of it was. It's actually, there's a lot of kind of dry description of political, etc. But the minute Lisbeth appears on the page, the whole thing starts to happen. And I think you're absolutely right, Cassie, that she was what came out of that book. That was what people wanted to talk about. And they talked about her in relation to Pippi Longstocking and all sorts of other connections that people were making with that character, who proved to have such longevity and such impact.
But I think it's interesting that Mankell, as you mentioned, he still had, the main characters are quite tired detectives that you've seen in so many other books. So he never really pushed the genre that much, because there also been a political discussion in previous books. But what Stieg Larsson did was push the characters, and not just Lisbeth, also Blomqvist is very interesting. He's almost like a Swedish James Bond in a way. He's quite tough, but at the same time, he goes on these great adventures, but he has the very soft side as well. So I think he is intriguing as well. But there's no, I mean, my daughter, now is 19, reading the first Stieg Larsson book, and she's completely hooked. I mean, this is so many years ago when he wrote them. And Lisbeth Salander still works as a captivating character. But it's interesting with this new book, though, because it's almost now they're trying to find a flavor. So all those characters from the first book, Karin Siminoff has tried to then develop them more to make them more kind of likable, or they get older and they more empathy. They have more empathy for the crooks or for where they are and all that stuff. At the same time, that's interesting, but also, on the other hand, they are a little bit watered down, that kind of peculiarity.
Well, the first book came at the absolute beginning of the giant crest of Scandi Noir, which the world became obsessed with. I mean, it even began to influence Homewares design. Yeah. You know, the what's the word for cozy?
Hygge.
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 There you go. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I'm really interested in what you think about how and why Scandi Noir has spread so much in the world. There is something in those stories. Doesn't matter if you live in Wagga Wagga or if you live in Kathmandu, there's something very appealing about the genre. What is your take on that?
I think there's two things going on. I think that there's certainly, when you read for the first time The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, you wanted to read the next one. You know, you wanted something like it, but different. The publishers picked up on this and the publishers started to send more. I started to get more and more Scandinavian crime novels to review. There was obviously an opportunistic desire to push more, and more authors started to come across. And I think the same actually happened with the television series. I mean, the two series that popularized Nordic noir on television were, of course, The Bridge and The Killing. Mm. Those two series were made for Danish public television. They weren't really made for an international audience. They were astonished when they took off. Mm. And then what happened is that the popularity of those overseas, once it had broken in Britain and once we had started to watch them on SBS here, it was a niche audience. It was actually a rather niche audience, the makers, the producers and the writers of TV who were watching this and going, we could do that. We could use this landscape. We could use that darkness. We need to use these to tell these stories. And it actually became the international style of telling television crime.
Well, let's get back to the book in front of us. As we said, just to do a quick recap, there was The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, The Girl Who Played with Fire and The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest. And they were all written by Stieg Larsson. Mm. And then the series continued with three more novels written by another Swedish writer, David Lagercrantz. And now there are two more, there's going to be three, written by another writer. So who is this writer, Karin Smirnoff, who has taken up this series?
She's a very celebrated fiction writer, and she writes, I think, solely from the perspective of the north of the country. And there's family tragedies, there's extreme violence in families, that dads are alcoholic and beats everyone up. And she has created a series around this character. And I think that's what's one of the reasons they chose her. Because you mentioned Stieg Larsson and David Lagercrantz. They were journalists. Both of them were journalists. And you can almost feel that when you read the story, that they pushes the story very fast. It's always action happen. But in her writing, there's much more kind of backstory, and you get a more sense how people are feeling, and you get also a wonderful sense of the landscape more than these other writers. She's more descriptive, I would say. It's very interesting, I find, is that the two journalists, they actually wasn't sure who the third writer was going to be. So they went with another crime writer first and said, can you write an example? Like, just write a few paragraphs. And he wrote a whole book. And his name was Johan Ajvide Lindqvist. And his book was in that same vein, but they thought it's just too much of the same. We want something completely different. And what he did, he took back his book and then he just changed the characters, changed the names and the ages of people. And his books became huge hits in Sweden as well. Even though when you read them, you can see that there is the outlines, a bit of the Millennium series. But she is the one who, Karin Smirnoff, had breathed a new, fresh life into the Millennium series, and especially her first book.
Because the other thing that all of the books have also had is a lot of politics, political conspiracies. And so it's a very complicated world that we are now entering into in this latest one, The Girl with Ice in Her Veins. I'll confess, I hadn't read the books in between. So I had a lot to catch up with, a lot of things that happened in Lisbeth Salander's life. I had to catch up with some new villains, the death of Lisbeth Brother's wife, Marta, in an earlier book. And she died, this woman died in the arms of her teenage daughter, Svala. Mm. Svala now feels like the focus of this new novel. She's only 14 years old. She lives with her uncle. She's at high school. She's doing work experience at the local newspaper. And all sorts of things happen around her that take us into the world of environmentalism, climate change. But can I confess, Johan, I got a little confused. This is a very complicated book. I got a bit lost.
But you see, if you read the first book by Karin Smirnoff, you won't get lost because it's written with all that's politics and the mining industry and the corruptness, but it still has that unique style, which is poetic and make real flesh and blood characters. In this one, the new one, I feel like she has gone so fast. Like there's no development of the characters. It's very short chapters. So you're always on a treadmill and it gets a bit tiring. And I agree with you. You start to confuse the plots and slightly lose interest as well. So I hope that in her third book that she will come back to the first book's writing, the skills she had in writing that, because that was so fresh. It was like a new universe that was created, she created.
So I guess what we've done here is sort of set up the context for this story, and we're not going to be able to go into a whole lot of detail, but what I did want to ask you about in terms of the north of Sweden is something that I've read in so much Swedish fiction, because that is the story of the First Nations people of this part of the world, the Sami people who are reindeer herders and who I think still have quite a sort of underclass position and are treated quite differently. So there's racism, all sorts of stuff going on. How important is it that we have this element of the story, that we hear about the Sami people?
I mean, the backstory is quite ugly. I mean, they, for instance, two examples. My mother was raised, came from a little village up in the north and her father was the priest, the local priest. And way back in the church was this very simple little bench. And it was for the Sami people where they could sit, you know, and it was like a small bench. So it was almost like, we don't want to see you, but you are kind of welcome to come into the church. And then I had a cousin who studied to be a veterinarian, and his job was to measure skulls of all the people that came down the tube. So he had to measure them, because the Sami people, there was the myth that they were they had high skulls or low skulls, and they were supposed to have low skulls. And that means that they were, then with that racist theories that was in the 56, they were more prone to crimes and drinking.
So all those eugenics ideas,
protein. And so I think that colored a lot how they were treated a lot in the north. And it's only this past, I'm not exactly how I can say if it's 10 or 15 years, that Sami culture has completely reversed. You are very celebrated. We have great books and films and TV shows about Sami people, because people, it's almost like an undiscovered gem in Swedish culture. It took a long time, actually.
And that is embedded into the plot of this fairly complicated novel, which I think, Sue Turnbull, you had a go at reading as well.
I had a go at it as well, and my take is slightly different. As I was reading it, and I read those first 60 pages twice to try and get a handle on it, and I figured I was tired and maybe I wasn't paying enough attention. Had two goes. And the second time I read it, I thought, oh, no, it's not me, it's it. And then I started to think, this is written as if it's written for television. It's written in scenes. And if you were looking at the scenes, it would make more sense. But in terms of a style for writing a book, there was no hook pulling me through. Mm.
So, Johan, we need to go back and read the book before this in order to appreciate The Girl with Ice in Her Veins. Is that...
Yes, it helps you. That wonderful first book where actually she has just created a new kind of milieu for them. They have age, you know, Blomqvist now have prostate problems, he have high blood pressure, he feels like he's unemployed, his fantastic Millennium newspaper is turning into a blog, he's really depressed and all this stuff. Like Stieg Larsson would never touch that, and David Lagercrantz never mentioned that in a word either. They're old heroes of this series. That's what's missing in her, in the girl with the ice in her veins. That kind of existentialism. Where am I? Where I'm going, you know? Because they're always going somewhere in the other books.
So we're celebrating the series, but slightly lukewarm on the cold of the latest. And it is by Karin Smirnoff, The Girl with Ice in Her Veins, translated from the Swedish by Sara Dieth, published by Mäkelhöjs Press.
This is The Bookshelf on ABC Radio National. I'm Cassie McCullough here with Kate Evans and our guests today, Swedish-Australian documentary maker Johan Gabrielsson and academic crime reviewer Sue Turnbull. And Sue, you're going to give us an overview of the best recent crime fiction. In fact, we'll whip through a whole pile of it.
So are you seeing any patterns as you look at your pile of books that you've selected for us, Sue?
I certainly did. After the fact, I suddenly realised that I'd picked 1, 2, 3, 4 books that are all what I would call rural noir. You know, once upon a time, Australian crime fiction was city-based. You know, we had Melbourne, we had Peter Corris in Sydney, we had Peter Temple in Melbourne. Though, you know, he did go along the coast for Broken Shore. But things have shifted. In fact, one of the authors that we'll be talking about, Jane Harper, and indeed another one, Chris Hammer, I think are responsible for that whole shift and the popularity, which a lot of people have jumped on the bandwagon now, you know, small town secrets, rural Australia. But these are four books that I think are really of interest because they also touch on really big themes.
Okay, well, let's kick off with one, and that's Michael Brissenden's Dust. Again, regional crime.
It's regional crime. Now, Michael Brissenden, of course, is a journalist, well known as a political journalist. This is his fourth crime novel, and I am confident in saying it's definitely his best. It moved me to tears, and that doesn't often happen. We're out far, far west of New South Wales in a place called Lake Haddon, where there's no lake. It's just a dry bed. The water has receded. We've got a young man who lives in a trailer park, and he wanders out onto the lake because he thinks he's seen something. What he's actually seen is what I call a murder of crows, and there's a body, and he goes out and he thinks it might be his missing father, Dog, who was a bit of a dog. But he gets there and it's not. And who it is, in fact, is a young environmental journalist who's been asking questions around town. Now, that brings in the police from Sydney, and we have a jaded, you know, world-weary policeman, Martin Kravitz, and a young up-and-coming police woman who comes through the kind of university school and quotes Shakespeare. So you've got these odd couple in the car arriving in Lake Haddon to investigate this particular death. While that's going on, the real story is Aaron's, and Aaron Love is the centre of this book because he's also searching not just for his father, he's searching for a young woman who turned up and stayed with him in his trailer and who he thinks might just have been about sex, but he thinks it might also be about love, and he wants to find her. So the two things are going on, the investigation of the journalist, which leads us into bikie gangs and drug wars and trucking companies and all that kind of stuff, the East and the West and Sydney and the city. But in the background, Brisson has also got his eyes on all the journalistic things that are going on. Sky News is playing everywhere, and everybody in the bush is deeply suspicious of climate change and environmental issues, even as their farms are being bought up for wind farms and solar farms. So there's that going on, and that environmental note actually is struck in all the books that I'm going to talk about that have this focus.
So that's Michael Brissenden's fourth. The next writer that you're going to talk about, I think, has about 60 novels to his name, and that, of course, is Gary Disher.
The wonderful Gary Disher, who cannot really write a bad book, I don't think. This is number 5 in the Paul Hirschhausen series. We're in, let's call it outback South Australia. We're in a small town called Tiverton. And I was talking to a friend about these books, and she said, I love it when Hirsch walks the streets of Tiverton and talks to the various people that in this small town population, something like 200. And she said, I can see it. I can feel it. I know those people. I can smell it. This is a real layer cake, though. There are so many plot lines going on in here. We've got a young woman searching for evidence of what happened to her mother. Her father was found dead. Her mother is missing. They were out prospecting. Their dog was found on the road. So that's a central theme that carries through. But around, there are all these other little plot lines. There's a sovereign citizen who's terrorizing locals by driving them off the road. Hirsch himself is dealing with his mother, whose their father has recently been killed in a road accident, and her mother is grieving. So there's all these different layers going on. It's beautifully done, beautifully managed. And of course, ultimately, everything comes together in that incredible way that he does.
Gary Disher is somebody who does a bit of a slow burn in his fiction, whereas Chris Hammer's legacy literally starts with a bang. There are explosions, there's action, it all takes off.
It's a return to Martin Skarsten, who was the hero of Scrublands. It's this number four in the series. And Martin, you know, is sort of married and got a child. And, you know, for anybody reading crime fiction, married bliss is not a great premise for a crime novel. You need somebody to be in a bit more trouble. So, in fact, Hammer puts him in a whole load of trouble. He's just about to launch a book about a local mobster, and the community hall where they're about to do it blows up. So Martin is quickly exited through Asio and told to drive west, which he does. He keeps driving west, and he stops at this little place called Port Peru, which he thinks is a bit of a joke because the river is dry, there is no port, there's no water anywhere, but he's told a storm is coming. And when the storm comes in Northern Territories, it washes down and there's going to be floods and the roads are going to be impassable. So he's stuck in Port Peru. And there, of course, is where the kind of stories start. But what Hammer does is he's done this in the past, is he uses a diary and he uses another character to set up a plot which is about two warring families. It's really rather gorgeous. It's like the Hatfield and the McCoys. There's one ranch up there and there's one ranch down there, and the young woman from that ranch is supposed to have killed the young man from the other ranch. They were supposed to be married. She disappeared. He's dead and the war is still going on. And that's the kind of background plot. It's great. There's stuff about Australian history. There's a mystery of some potential explorers who went through on Leichhardt's trail. I think it's one of Chris's best books for a while. I really enjoyed it.
Okay, quite a wrap.
Look, we keep on, well, I guess with the Gary Disher and Chris Hammer, we have returning characters. Now, with Jane Harper's latest, Last One Out, is she returning to her earlier characters or is this one a standalone?
It's another standalone, but it actually, in many ways, is more similar to The Dry than any book that she's written in between. It's beautifully written. We're in a small town called Carolyn Ridge, and this young man is driving out to explore three abandoned properties. He gets out of the car, and that's where we stop. He's never seen again. His mother and his father, Ro and Griff, are waiting for him at home. They've made his birthday lasagna. It's cold on the kitchen table. They go out looking for him. He has disappeared. We shift to 5 years later, and the town is dying. The town is going, and just over the ridge is the massive mine. And that's the backdrop. Again, environmental issues pressing on this small town community. Even though it has all these echoes of The Dry, and it's, as I said, beautifully written, I actually found it very ponderous. It's 368 pages. It's slow and not a lot happens. There's a lot of meditation on grief. And there really wasn't a character, you know, unlike Aaron Love in The Brissenden or unlike Skarsten, there wasn't a character that really captivated me as much as Sam, who disappears in the first few pages. He's the one that if you're interested in, you stay with the book to find out what happened to him. But in some ways I found it actually a bit disappointing, but I'd be really interested to hear what other people think.
Interesting. Thank you, Sue. I think a lot of people had a little gulp in their throat when the next book arrived in the post, and that's Murder in the Cathedral by Kerry Greenwood, who died earlier this year. So this is the last ever Phryne Fisher book.
It is, but it's a joyous, joyous romp. There's not a shadow. The first 50 pages, I started to read in a bar. And you know when you're laughing in a bar when you're reading? It's really embarrassing. People are kind of looking at me and I'm going, sorry. I laughed out loud. It's just so funny. Her observations about the boring basalt plains north of Melbourne. Phryne and Dot are on their way to Bendigo. Phryne's old friend Lionel is about to be elevated to the position of local bishop in Bendigo. He's invited Phryne and Dot to the inauguration. He thinks it's going to be a lark. So anyway, they turn up in Bendigo. Lionel meets them off the train. And Phryne's got so many suitcases because, of course, she has an outfit for every single eventuality so that she can't sit in the car. She travels on the running board. abroad. They're staying in a glorious hotel. And within the first day, she has this three-course lunch and wine and sherry, and then goes for a nap and then has a three-course dinner and after drinks. And it's all those Kerry things, that Enid Blytonish love of food, you know, the sumptuous repasts, lashings of ginger beer, in other words, you know, kind of feature. So there's all these details going on. The inauguration happens. There's a glorious young man. Kerry always loved a glorious young man somewhere in the plot, singing. And while he's singing, one of the clergy is stabbed through the heart. That's the motivating mystery. And of course, Phryne is then helping the police. Just to cap it off, there's a glorious moment at the end which recalls book two, Flying High, where she is in a gypsy moth with Watson, the local policeman, behind her, terrified out of his mind, and she is having a gleeful time on the chase of the criminals. And it ends, well, I'm not going to tell you where it ends, but it's perfect.
Wow. Okay, well, Valet Kerry Greenwood, and her final book is called Murder in the Cathedral.
Okay, so we've been hearing, Sue, about a lot of regional crime, and you mentioned that there's been a shift in Australian crime fiction away from the city. Well, there's still an awful lot of international crime fiction that is set in cities. So I might just mention Michael Connolly's latest. It's called The Proving Ground. He's always exploring his city of Los Angeles. That's the place that he uses crime to explore. He also has so many different characters who he revisits. This latest one is part of the Lincoln Lawyer series. Mickey Haller is the central character, and the proving ground is that space in front of juries where the lawyer sort of performs his work. But he also brings back another really terrific character, an investigative journalist called Jack McAvoy. And what he's looking at is a murder in which the other forces that are implicated are AI bots. And Michael Connolly is somebody who loves investigating contemporary issues, and he always sets his novel in the year that the book comes out. So there are wildfires in Los Angeles. There is what's going on with artificial intelligence. So that one has also just come out.
Well, Sue Turnbull and Johan Gabrielsen, what great reviewing. Just a couple of recommendations before we let you go. First to you, Johan, what have you read lately that you like?
Well, I found a crime writer that almost as good as the Millennium series. The writer's name is John Ajvide Lindqvist. His book is called The Writing in the Water. His second book is called The Room in the Ground, and they are absolutely riveting. And well, very popular in Europe or in Sweden right now is a male writers in their 30s, 40s from Germany and France. And one of them is Christian Kracht, who has written, his short stories are fascinating because he creates universe very quickly that you just never read anything like it before. And he also have developed a very specific language that dominates his later book. So he's a fascinating writer to look out for, Christian Kracht. And the name of the book that's put him on the scene, if you want, it's called The Dead.
Okay, Christian Kracht. Great. And of course, we list all the books that we mention on the program page, so don't worry if you can't keep up with this incredible cavalcade of quite interesting novels. What about you, Sue? What would you like to recommend?
My hit book of this year so far is Sam Guthrie's The Peak. I love a political thriller. I love a political thriller that really takes you somewhere completely different. So we're in Hong Kong and we're in Australia. And it's set really in the space of 24 hours, from an epic opening to an epic ending. I think there's a possibility of a sequel, but I loved it.
Yeah, it's a great book set. Well, begins in the Senate wing of Parliament House, which you wouldn't think is the most fascinating place for a drama, but my goodness, it begins with a bang, doesn't it? Mm. Amazing book. Okay. Well, thank you both. It's been wonderful to have you as our reviewers today.
Thank you for having me. I love to be here.
Thank you, Cassie and Kate. What fun.
Johan Gabrielsen is a documentary maker whose latest film, Climate Changes, is screening around the country at the moment. And Sue Turnbull is both a crime reviewer and an academic analyst of her favourite genre. Her latest book is the co-authored collection Migrants, Television and Australian Stories.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of The Bookshelf, but we'll be back next time with guests Stuart Coop, looking at The Boy from the North Country by Sam Sussman, which has a connection, or does it, to Bob Dylan. And also the novelist Hannah Kent joins us to read Sarah Hall's novel Helm.
So make sure you join us for those books. I'm Kate Evans.
I'm Cassie McCullough. See you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.